The following NPR program is made possible by an unrestricted events coverage fund supported by grants from the Mobile Corporation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From National Public Radio in Washington, a special report. President Reagan speaks to the Congress. I'm Linda Wertheimer. In just a few moments, President Ronald Reagan will enter the chamber of the House of Representatives to speak to a joint session of the House and Senate to make a plea for the Congress to accept his program for economic recovery. The president has not made a public appearance on national television since he was shot just over a month ago. Correspondent William Drummond is here with me in the NPR studio. Bill, I guess the thing that everyone is most interested in, since we've heard the president make his plea for the economy before, is how the president looks and how well he'll seem. Have you seen anything of him in the last couple of days at the White House?
I've seen a fleeting glimpse of him as he got off the helicopter from Camp David yesterday. We've had testaments from many visitors who've seen him, and they all say that he looks very, very good.
Mr. Speaker, President of the United States.
The president is just entering the House.
That was the doorkeeper of the House who makes that familiar announcement. And the president comes in with a kind of honor guard of members of the House and Senate escorting him, shaking hands, walking down the aisle.
Oh, God.
Wearing what looks like a blue suit and a bright blue tie with the same kind of fresh Irish coloring that we're used to seeing. He does look well.
And Linda, you'll notice he's carrying things under his left arm, and he seems to be moving it about. There doesn't seem to be that apparent stiffness that we recognized some days earlier.
He's reached the front of the chamber and has stepped up to the rostrum where he will speak, is waving and smiling, and of course a tremendous cheer from the members of the Senate and the House, from the President's Cabinet, and from people who are in the galleries. He gives a copy of the speech to the Speaker of the House. He's looking up now at the gallery, the family gallery. And, of course, chamber is filled and the members are standing. Mrs. Reagan is with Mrs. Howard Baker, Joy Dirksen Baker, in the family gallery. Mr. Baker, Senator Baker, is the majority leader of the Senate of the United States.
Thank you very much.
The Speaker of the House is presiding together with the President of the Senate, who is Vice President of the United States, George Bush, the Speaker, Thomas P. O'Neill. It's a great cheer up from the crowd. And Speaker O'Neill continues to applaud, letting the people in the chamber give full vent to their emotions.
House will be in order.
That's the Speaker, Thomas P. O'Neill of Massachusetts.
Members of the Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Once again, everyone standing, everyone cheering and applauding. The President seems to be moved by the display of support for him.
Thank you.
He's asking everyone to sit down, but they're not.
Thank you very much.
Smiling, waving, looking at the galleries.
Thank you.
You
wouldn't want to talk me into an encore, would you? Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, distinguished members of the Congress, honored guests and fellow citizens, I have no words to express my appreciation for that greeting. I have come to speak to you tonight about our economic recovery program and why I believe it's essential that the Congress approve this package, which I believe will lift the crushing burden of inflation off of our citizens and restore the vitality to our economy and our industrial machine. First, however, and due to events of the past few weeks, will you permit me to digress for a moment from the all-important subject of why we must bring government spending under control and reduce tax rates? I'd like to say a few words directly to all of you and to those who are watching and listening tonight, because this is the only way I know to express to all of you on behalf of Nancy and myself our appreciation for your messages, your flowers, and most of all, your prayers, not only for me, but for those others who fell beside me. The warmth of your words, the expression of friendship, and yes, love, meant more to us than you can ever know. You have given us a memory that we'll treasure forever. And you've provided an answer to those few voices that were raised saying that what happened was evidence that ours is a sick society. The society we heard from is made up of millions of compassionate Americans and their children from college age to kindergarten. As a matter of fact, as evidence of that, I have a letter with me. The letter came from Peter Sweeney. He's in the second grade in the Riverside School in Rockville Center. And he said, "I hope you get well quick, or you might have to make a speech in your pajamas." And he added a postscript. P.S., if you have to make a speech in your pajamas, I warned you. Well, sick societies don't produce men like the two who recently returned from outer space. Sick societies don't produce young men like Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy, who placed his body... placed his body between mine and the man with the gun simply because he felt that's what his duty called for him to do. Sick societies don't produce dedicated police officers like Tom Delahanty. Or able and devoted public servants like Jim Brady. Sick societies don't make people like us so proud to be Americans and so very proud of our fellow citizens. Now, let's talk about getting spending and inflation under control and cutting your tax rates. Mr. Speaker and Senator Baker, I want to thank you for your cooperation in helping to arrange this joint session of the Congress. I won't be speaking to you very long tonight, but I asked for this meeting because the urgency of our joint mission has not changed. Thanks to some very fine people, my health is much improved. I'd like to be able to say that with regard to the health of the economy. It's been half a year since the election that charged all of us in this government with the task of restoring our economy. Where have we come in these 6 months? Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, has continued at a double-digit rate. Mortgage interest rates have averaged almost 15% for these 6 months, preventing families across America from buying homes. There are still almost 8 million unemployed. The average worker's hourly earnings, after adjusting for inflation, are lower today than they were 6 months ago, and there have been over 6,000 business failures. 6 months is long enough. The American people now want us to act, and not in half measures. They demand, and they've earned, a full and comprehensive effort to clean up our economic mess. Because of the extent of our economy's sickness, we know that the cure will not come quickly, and that even with our package, progress will come in inches and feet, not in miles. But to fail to act will delay even longer and more painfully the cure which must come. And that cure begins with the federal budget. And the budgetary actions taken by the Congress over the next few days will determine how we respond to the message of last November 4th. That message was very simple. Our government is too big and it spends too much. For the last few months, you and I have enjoyed a relationship based on extraordinary cooperation. Because of this cooperation, we've come a long distance in less than 3 months. I want to thank the leadership of the Congress for helping in setting a fair timetable for consideration of our recommendations. And committee chairmen on both sides of the aisle have called prompt and thorough hearings. We have also communicated in a spirit of candor, openness, and mutual respect. Tonight, as our decision day nears, and as the House of Representatives weighs its alternatives, I wish to address you in that same spirit. The Senate Budget Committee, under the leadership of Pete Domenici, has just today voted out a budget resolution supported by Democrats and Republicans alike that is, in all major respects, consistent with the program that we have proposed. Now, we look forward to favorable action on the Senate floor, but an equally crucial test involves the House of Representatives. The House will soon be choosing between two different versions or measures to deal with the economy. One is the measure offered by the House Budget Committee. The other is a bipartisan measure, a substitute introduced by Congressman Phil Graham of Texas and Del Latta of Ohio. On behalf of the administration, let me say that we embrace and fully support that bipartisan substitute. It will achieve all the essential aims of controlling government spending, reducing the tax burden, building a national defense second to none, and stimulating economic growth and creating millions of new jobs. At the same time, however, I must state our opposition to the measure offered by the House Budget Committee. It may appear that we have two alternatives. In reality, however, there are no more alternatives left. The committee measure, quite simply, falls far too short of the essential actions that we must take. For example, in the next 3 years, the committee measure projects spending $141 billion more than does the bipartisan substitute. It regrettably cuts over $14 billion in essential defense spending, funding required to restore America's national security. It adheres to the failed policy of trying to balance the budget on the taxpayers' back. it would increase tax payments by over a third, adding up to a staggering $250 billion. Federal taxes would increase 12% each year. Taxpayers would be paying a larger share of their income to government in 1984 than they do at present. In short, that measure reflects an echo of the past rather than a benchmark for the future. High taxes and excess spending growth created our present economic mess. More of the same will not cure the hardship, anxiety, and discouragement it has imposed on the American people. Let us cut through the fog for a moment. The answer to a government that's too big is to stop feeding its growth. Government spending has been growing faster than the economy itself. The massive national debt which we accumulated is the result of the government's high spending diet. Well, it's time to change the diet and to change it in the right way. I know the tax portion of our package is of concern to some of you, but let me make a few points that I feel have been overlooked. First of all, it should be looked at as an integral part of the entire package, not something separate and apart from the budget reductions, the regulatory relief, and the monetary restraints. Probably the most common misconception is that we are proposing to reduce government revenues to less than what the government has been receiving. This is not true. Actually, the discussion has to do with how much of a tax increase should be imposed on the taxpayer in 1982. Now, I know that over the recess, in some informal polling, some of your constituents have been asked which they'd rather have, a balanced budget or a tax cut. And with the common sense that characterizes the people of this country, the answer, of course, has been a balanced budget. But may I suggest, with no inference that there was wrong intent on the part of those who asked the question was inappropriate to the situation. Our choice is not between a balanced budget and a tax cut. Properly asked, the question is, do you want a great big raise in your taxes this coming year? Or at the worst, a very little increase with the prospect of tax reduction and a balanced budget down the road a ways. With the common sense that the people have already shown, I'm sure we all know what the answer to that question would be. A gigantic tax increase has been built into the system. We propose nothing more than a reduction of that increase. The people have a right to know that even with our plan, they will be paying more in taxes, but not as much more as they will without it. The option, I believe, offered by the House Budget Committee will leave spending too high and tax rates too high. At the same time, I think it cuts the defense budget too much. And by attempting to reduce the deficit through higher taxes, it will not create the kind of strong economic growth and the new jobs that we must have. Let us not overlook the fact that the small independent businessman or woman creates more than 80% of all the new jobs and employs more than half of our total workforce. Our across-the-board cut in tax rates for a three-year period will give them much of the incentive and promise of stability they need to go forward with expansion plans calling for additional employees. Tonight, I renew my call for us to work as a team, to join in cooperation so that we find answers which will begin to solve all our economic problems and not just some of them. The economic recovery package that I've outlined to you over the past few weeks is, I deeply believe, the only answer that we have left. Reducing the growth of spending, cutting marginal tax rates, providing relief from overregulation, and following a non-inflationary and predictable monetary policy are interwoven measures which will ensure that we have addressed each of the severe dislocations which threaten our economic future. These policies will make our economy stronger, and the stronger economy will balance the budget, which we're committed to do by 1984. When I took the oath of office, I pledged loyalty to only one special interest group. We, the people. Those people, neighbors and friends, shopkeepers and laborers, farmers and craftsmen, do not have infinite patience. As a matter of fact, some 80 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt wrote these instructive words in his first message to the Congress. The American people are slow to wrath. But when their wrath is once kindled, it burns like a consuming flame. Well, perhaps that kind of wrath will be deserved if our answer to these serious problems is to repeat the mistakes of the past. The old and comfortable way is to shave a little here and add a little there. Well, that's not acceptable anymore. I think this great and historic Congress knows that way is no longer acceptable. I think you've shown that you know the one sure way to continue the inflationary spiral is to fall back into the predictable patterns of old economic practices. Isn't it time that we tried something new? When you allowed me to speak to you here in these chambers a little earlier, I told you that I wanted this program for economic recovery to be ours, yours and mine. I think the bipartisan substitute bill has achieved that purpose. It moves us toward economic vitality. Just 2 weeks ago, you and I joined millions of our fellow Americans in marveling at the magic historical moment that John Young and Bob Crippen created in their space shuttle Columbia. The last manned effort was almost 6 years ago, and I remembered on this more recent day over the years, how we'd all come to expect technological precision of our men and machines, and each amazing achievement became commonplace until the next new challenge was raised. With a space shuttle, we tested our ingenuity once again, moving beyond the accomplishments of the past into the promise and uncertainty of the future. Thus, we not only planned to send up a 122-foot aircraft 170 miles into space, but we also intended to make it maneuverable and return it to Earth, landing 98 tons of exotic metals delicately on a remote dry lake bed. The space shuttle did more than prove our technological abilities. It raised our expectations once more. It started us dreaming again. The poet Carl Sandburg wrote, "The Republic is a dream. Nothing happens unless first a dream." And that's what makes us as Americans different. We've always reached for a new spirit and aimed at a higher goal. We've been courageous and determined, unafraid and bold. Who among us wants to be first to say we no longer have those qualities? That we must limp along, doing the same things that have brought us our present misery. I believe that the people you and I represent are ready to chart a new course. They look to us to meet the great challenge, to reach beyond the commonplace and not fall short for lack of creativity or courage. Someone you know has said that he who would have nothing to do with thorns must never attempt to gather flowers. But we have much greatness before us. We can restore our economic strength and build opportunities like none we've ever had before. As Carl Sandburg said, all we need to begin with is a dream that we can do better than before. All we need to have is faith, and that dream will come true. All we need to do is act, and the time for action is now. Thank you.
Once again, the members of Congress, members of the House and Senate, the President's Cabinet, guests in the galleries, are all on their feet cheering for the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan. He shakes hands with Vice President Bush and with the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, still waving and smiling. He follows the doorkeeper of the House, Mr. Malloy, and begins the journey back down the center aisle. He's just being congratulated by his Chief of Staff, Ed Meese, the Majority Leader of the Senate and the Minority Leader. The members of the Senate who are escorting the President. I believe I see a Secret Service agent on the floor with the President, and that is unusual. He's shaking hands with Congressman Jack Kemp, with the Secretary of State, Alexander Haig. Congressman Kemp is author of the tax bill that has become a part of the President's Economic Recovery Program, the Kemp-Roth Tax Cut. Shaking hands with both hands now. Looks as though he is not particularly bothered by the wound in his side, who received a month ago. Smiling. The President's color is high, as it always is when he's made a speech. Those little bright red dots on his cheeks that appear when he's given a rousing talk. Shaking hands with Congressman Kilberg of California, new Republican member of the House. I beg your pardon. I just gave her the wrong name.
Linda, I think you're right. There is a Secret Service agent who's immediately behind the President. He has this earphone in his ear and this little metal pin in his lapel.
It has never been customary for agents to go onto the floor of the House or the Senate for any reason. The Senate has its own security. The House and Senate have their own security personnel, and they generally do not. Generally, agents, the Vice President's agents, wait outside the door for him. But a joint session of the Congress is not, strictly speaking, the Congress in session. And so there may be an exception made. The President has left the chamber, and we're watching, and we can hear the members of the House and Senate sort of milling around on the floor now, as they will for a while. The President will return to the White House. He'll be whisked out, as they say, through the door, one of those doors under the porches of the Capitol, and get into his limousine, drive back to the White House, and there will be no traffic movement on the Capitol Plaza until he is gone. It only takes a few minutes, but I'm sure that security must be very tight for the President on this first trip out. Bill Drummond, let's talk first about the President's health. It seemed to me to be in to be very well.
He bore up very well under this. I was surprised that he was able to use the left side of his body with as much flexibility. In that sort of a crowded situation, you'd think that maybe someone would jostle him. And he was in surgery only a month ago. I would think that maybe his left side would be tender. It was cut very deeply through muscle, but he showed no hesitation about using it at all. He didn't seem to be even moving with those sort of stiff movements that we had noticed a few days ago.
And his color is good. He looks very well. He moves well. He was shaking hands with both hands as he went down the aisle, a sort of standard political fashion. And he his voice was perhaps not all that it has been. And that may have something to do with the fact that he had a bullet in his lung, which probably makes him a little
short of breath.
Right. But still, I think for all those people who were worrying about him, this would be a very comforting thing to see the president in such excellent form tonight. And, of course, it was a tremendous reception, as you would imagine it would be.
The reception, I think, it made the House of Representatives sound like a political convention.
It did.
It was that sort of spirit and that sort of almost uproarious cheering that was going on. It made it appear as though he was accepting the nomination at a political convention. And I think, as you noticed, the president was quite moved by this. When he first began to speak, there was a little bit of, just a little touch of emotion in his voice.
Right. The speech began with the thanks to all the people who've written and sent things to him, and all of the concern that the American people have expressed for his health, and a sort of a thank you to all of them, and a tribute to the people who were wounded when he was. But he moved very quickly. On the first page of his speech, now let's talk about getting spending and inflation under control, he said, getting right down to business, and made a very strong pitch for his plan over the plan which has been offered by Budget Committee Chairman James Jones of Oklahoma in the House of Representatives. He made some comparisons between his plan and the House Budget Committee's plan. And he said that the House Budget Committee projects more spending than the president wants, that it cuts defense spending more than the president wants, that it does not cut taxes enough, and that it's doing business in the same old way. I think in fairness to Mr. Jones's proposal, we probably ought to say that when you're talking about cutting, the president is apparently talking about cutting using his own plan as a benchmark rather than present spending as a benchmark. And Mr. Jones does not increase taxes. He does not cut taxes as much as the president does. Mr. Jones does not have a deficit in his plan of the size the deficit in the president's plan either, but the president didn't mention that. But he made a very strong pitch, and in sort of the strongest, most political case that he could make, it seems to me, for his position.
And I think this is the first time, if I'm not mistaken, that the president has himself spoken on the Graham-Latta bipartisan plan, and it's the first time that he's spoken directly himself, I think, on the Jones alternative.
The Graham-Latta plan is very close to the president's own version. It makes a few minor changes, but it is sponsored by a very conservative Democrat from Texas, Phil Graham, and the ranking Republican on the Budget Committee, Del Latta of Ohio, hence its name. It is bipartisan in the sense that Mr. Graham and the conservative Democrats feel similarly to the way he does, are supporting it. And it looks very strong in the House at this moment because there are enough of those conservative Democrats, at least the Republican leadership thinks there are enough, that they can defeat the Democratic budget and pass the president's version, Graham-Latta, as it's now called. I also thought it was interesting that the president went straight to the problem area that he has in his economic recovery package and spent a good deal of time, as he says, he wants to cut through the fog. He wanted to go right straight to taxes and talk about tax cuts. He said, I know the tax portion of our package is of some concern to you, and I think that's quite clear in the Congress. It's been my perception in the House and Senate that while the president's spending cuts are on a very fast track, the tax cuts, many members of Congress think they're just a bit too large, that the deficits are too large, that the whole proposition is risky, and they're not sure they want to go along with it.
There was a point, Linda, about 12 minutes into the president's speech when he went on a digression about the apparently a poll that was taken during the Easter recess. And he digressed for about a minute talking about how a poll that had been taken was deceptive. Apparently the wording of the poll offered the person the choice of choosing between a tax cut and a balanced budget. And the president took pains to point out that that was not really the alternative that he was proposing, that it was not one or the other, that under his plan the tax cut, hopefully under all the assumptions that he has, would result in a lower budget, a lower budget deficit because of the increased productivity in the economy and therefore greater revenue return to the Treasury.
But it is also interesting that instead of making the very the sort of strong, you know, when you look at a body of data about of numbers, you can put a hard interpretation on it or a soft interpretation on it. On the spending side, he put a very hard interpretation on his plan, the Graham-Latta plan, versus Congressman Jones and the Democratic version of the budget. But when he started talking about taxes, I thought he really sort of soft-pedaled it, because instead of talking about his tax cut as a tax cut of historic size, a tax cut that's bigger than any tax cut since the Kennedy cut, the kind of rhetoric that we have heard from the president in the past, he says that what his tax cut is basically it reduces a giant tax increase which has been programmed into the system, that if his tax cut is not made, taxes will increase, and that all he's trying to do is hold the status quo. Now, that, it seems to me, must be intended to calm some of those concerns that were expressed in the informal polls he talked about, where members' constituents had said that they thought he was right on the spending cuts and they didn't care so much about the tax cut and maybe it would be better to wait until the economy had recovered.
But by the same token, it would cause the reasonable supply-side economists to ask whether a tax cut that is basically going to cause the population to stand still would be sufficient to attain the level of excess money in the pocket that would then result in new investment.
All the kinds of the saving and investing that we're all supposed to do with the money that the president is going to give back to us in this tax cut, as he's been telling us.
But it has evaporated in the president's rhetoric.
I suppose because he must be concerned about what he's hearing coming back from members of Congress who've returned from the recess. But certainly the president cannot be anything but encouraged about what he's hearing about the spending cuts, because what I have been hearing from members of Congress is that people have stepped up to Democratic senators and said, I want to know if you're for the president or against the president, yes or no. And they're not allowing them much latitude at all. And apparently the members of the Senate are feeling very strongly that the time has come to just stand aside and let this plan roll through.
That seems to be the tactic that's being taken, but I don't think that a number of organizations and interest groups are going to fold up and go away. Today I was speaking with Benjamin Hooks of the NAACP, who was in town to present the NAACP's alternative budget to the White House. He doesn't think he'll get very far with it, but he thinks that there is an education campaign that he's going to continue to wage. A number of groups, I think, will feel the same way. The president is going to have his way in Congress, but I think he'll still have some resistance in groups at large.
Bill, do you see any plans for, do you know of any plans for the president to move out now? Has this been his return to public life? Will he now resume a full schedule and public appearances and business as usual?
Not right away, Linda. He's up to, I would say, I'm estimating around 4 hours a day of work, and they are going to continue to add little by little until he reaches his full stamina. There are some appearances that he's going to make in the near future, at least he's scheduled to make, but I think they're going to keep him under a relatively light load. What we're looking forward to now are a couple of commencement addresses, one at Notre Dame that he had accepted before he was injured, and also at the United States Military Academy at West Point. And he's been there have been some rough drafts of speeches that have been floated by him. I think they'll still keep him on a fairly restricted schedule for a while.
And he went out to Camp David this weekend, and apparently he's picking up some recreational time, a little exercise and so on.
I think it's pretty a mild exercise, mainly consisting of walking. As you could tell, you know, he seems to be a little bit short of breath. I don't think he's quite ready to go horseback riding again. But again, for a 70-year-old man who's been through the kind of ordeal he's been through, it's proof to everyone who saw him and listened to him that his recovery is remarkable.
And the strength of his politics at the moment are in absolutely no doubt in the House and Senate of the United States, which is preparing to consider his budget and will do so over about the next 10 days. And the president's prospects are looking very good indeed, I think, after this speech tonight, Bill.
I think there's no doubt about that.
Thank you very much, Bill Drummond. This concludes the special report. Our engineers this evening have been Renee Pringle and Gary Henderson. John Isdey is our editor. The program was produced by Richard Firestone. For William Drummond, I'm Linda Wertheimer. Good evening from Washington.